The Africa Law Tech podcast explores the latest in law technology and entrepreneurship in the African continent. This weekly podcast is brought to you by the Lawyers Hub, a law tech organization working on digital policy and justice innovation in Africa. To find out more, visit lawyershub.org or email us on info@lawyershub.ke.
Thanks for joining us. This promises to be an interesting conversation. And so I just want to ask the speakers to come on stage now. We have with us already on stage is Irungu, who is the Executive Director at Amnesty International. We have Pat. His handle is Privacy Matters, and he tweets on really good stuff on privacy. And Robert Chirunda would introduce himself quickly as well. And then we will begin by remarks from Irungu.
So my name is Irungu Houghton. So my preliminary remarks would be, as we launch into this conversation, I guess four thoughts. The first is essentially that, in 2017, I was working with a group of people around a Matatu civic education project. And we did a survey. And at that time, 76% of the people we surveyed really feared violence as their major sense of, forbidding for the 2017 elections. There was very few people who actually feared, voter manipulation, digital manipulation. But I think this will definitely be different. The second reflection for me is that it is even, inconceivable, but it is just really sad that we are going into this election without the killers of Chris Musando not having been brought to court and charged with his murder. And Chris, of course, was working with the IABC. That morning I was on a television program with him and a breakfast show, and I really was struck by his mastery of the digital capability of IABC. But of course, he lost his life just before the elections. He was killed just before the elections. It is also quite scary that we still do not have any resolution in terms of the servers of 2017. Apparently, the French never woke up, actually. And then the third consideration, I guess, for me is really the recent breach of all of our data, those of us who found ourselves in political parties without any consent or even any choice in the matter. So as we turn to the election of 2022, I think we have to be present to a couple of things. The first is that we know already that the larger political parties have already developed their disinformation centers and that they are already beginning to look at the footprint of each one of us. They are looking at how to stymie to block the electoral systems. And while they're doing that, the cartels are essentially selecting their candidates. And we tend to say that party elections are the first stage in national elections. But actually, the first stage, which is not a public process, is that the corruption cartels are beginning to fund their candidates and beginning to think about what's happening. Qua ground, we're already hearing as Amnesty International that there are several places in the countries in which militia gangs are forming. And rather than being formed by politicians, they're actually forming themselves and offering themselves as consultant mercenaries ahead of the election. So what does this mean? Well, we have 11 million social media accounts in this country, about 7 million unique users, I'm told. The users are really in this kind of category. It is WhatsApp, Facebook and YouTube. This is going to be new. This election will be very visual, and it will be Photoshop both through the campaigns and the elections. And of course, as we all know, 17 million people have smartphones. And the thing that always boggles me, or rather confuses me, is 51% of the profiles on Twitter are anonymous. Now, what does this all mean? I'm hoping that somebody much smarter and much more connected to this conversation will tell us, and I suspect Cambridge Analytica will probably come up. I think for all of us, we have to essentially focus on two or three things. The first is the supremacy of the secret ballot, the importance of the ballot being secret so that we are protected. Secondly, that we stop voter suppression, whether it be digital or physical. Thirdly, that we make sure that everybody's vote counts. And thirdly, that we protect all the lives. We really have only one responsibility as we go into the election, which is to have six candidates clearly positioned for ourselves, if we are not standing ourselves, and to be clear that we are following one party. So I hope this kicks off the conversation
Thank you. Thank you so much, Irungu, for your opening remarks. And I really appreciate you for that. I think the statistics you give and also pointing out to the breach of data in Kenya by political parties is something that we must, you know, look into. So thank you very much, Irungu, for joining us. And now I'm going to go to Pat. You do some incredible work. Please let us know the work that you do first and why this topic, you know, resonates.
Okay, so thank you, Linda. And it's a pleasure to be here with you all. I've been in this space now for 25 years, so I'm a bit older than most, I think. I'm just fascinated by the impact of use of data on a broad range of fundamental rights and freedoms. We often just talk about privacy, but we forget the impact on freedom of speech, for example, on freedom of movement and association. So for me, I'm just fascinated by the use of data, but also concerned increasingly in the context of this, and just to go on from the previous speaker, when I look at Cambridge Analytica, there are some key themes that come out here. When I look at Cambridge Analytica in Kenya or in Nigeria and other countries, for example, the way in which data is gathered now is much more complex than ever it was, and much more detailed. So the data harvesting itself, it may involve a range of complex actors, which is, it could be an app provider, it could be data brokers, for example, it could be the social media platforms. But of course, the data itself is wanting to inform some action. And those actions are dependent increasingly on digital connectedness. So as the previous speaker was talking about people being connected more than ever before, the idea is that you can reach a broader range of people, that the data about them, you can begin to understand their social graph, you can understand the reach of that social graph. You can understand, for example, and capture data such as geolocation data, which can give you a very good understanding of precisely where individuals are, the communities they live in, because where they are also says something about the communities that they're living. Once you know which communities they're living in, you also begin to have an understanding of their political views, for example, their persuasion, how easily, what kind of messages might be better able to influence that community. And of course, you know, it's also possible to create scripts that mine for emotional data. So what are your political thoughts? What are your views? What are your beliefs? What are your religious beliefs? Because one of the things that strikes me here is that the use of digital data and digital connectedness, for me, they seek to exploit differences and divisions within communities and within society. We see that particularly in some African contexts, and particularly here in the UK, for example, in Brexit also, where it was believed that Cambridge Analytica was involved in that, and where there was a significant investigation. And just to give you some context, in the UK, the investigation estimated there to be over 130 billion data points in the data that was being used by Cambridge Analytica in the activities here in the UK. And something else, you know, previous speaker spoke about the Electoral Commission. One of the things I think that's going to have to happen is for different regulators to come together. So in Kenya now, you have your data protection commissioner, Immaculate, who I think is going to have to work and cooperate with others. So you also have to understand then, okay, we understand there's a problem. How do we address it? Is the law sufficient? But think about the UK regulator, which has a staff of 830 people and a budget of, I think the last time I looked, it was about 30 million, something like that. But in their investigation into Cambridge Analytica, it involved them reviewing 42 laptops and computers, 700 terabytes of data, 31 servers, and over 300,000 documents and a wide range of material in paper form and also data from cloud storage devices. So when we talk about Cambridge Analytica, and we talk about A, is the law fit for purpose, but also how you investigate, then we also have to consider, I think, whether the regulators are appropriately resourced. And that also brings you again, doesn't it, to when I look at the laws in Africa, you've got approximately, 34 now out of 53 countries, 54 countries, depending which list you read. Then given that this by its very nature is cross-border, then how will you enforce the law? How will you ensure regulatory cooperation, the sharing of intelligence and information within and without of Africa, for example? Do the laws mandate that? Does it provide a legal basis for your own regulators to ask regulators in another third country for data and for cooperation? And I think Sam Marfo is he might be on the call actually, studying in Canada and from Ghana, has written some excellent work as well about political campaigning and the role of data protection authorities, for example, but also wrote a very good paper on concerns over colonialism in Africa and Cambridge Analytica. And he raised a very good point that the to what degree do politicians facilitate this? So it's not, for me, just merely a hard data protection, human rights question, but it's also very much a political question and a question of political power and how you address that political power.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Pat, for that. And my final question to you is this. You linked digital identity to election data. I don't know what your comments are around Kenya's Huduma number and the fact that the government now has an updated and direct database in its own control of phone numbers, where you live. You know, the draft bill indicated that you actually had to indicate where you, if you move houses, then you need to actually update the government when you move houses. Do you see that that can be used as a tool of separation? Yet, you know, it comes in, you know, in a really good form of marketing digital identity. What's your thought on that?
So first of all, I'd like to thank all of those in civil society that fought Huduma number and took it to court and won. I think it's absolutely amazing. And I think if it wasn't for civil society in Kenya, the state of national identity would be far worse. So me, I think that there needs to be very clear limits on the use of that data for anything other than is clearly set out in law for the purposes of national identity. If they're going to tie it to voter registration systems, then there needs to be a proper human rights-based assessment of that that also looks at the proportionality and the necessity of that measure and the appropriate safeguards. Those safeguards must be set out in law, but there must also be the right of redress against abuse of that. And one thing that worries me, Linda, is when I look at some countries and one not far from Kenya at the moment, where not only do you have mandatory SIM registration, but I see worryingly a trend in different countries now where they are introducing also device registration databases linked to your national identity, linked to your biometric data, such that in some countries also you have to get permission from the police before you can sell or dispose of your phone. You have to report your mobile phone if you lose it, for example, or if it's stolen from you. So for me, there are multiple things: national digital identity, mandatory SIM registration, and device registration that creates a foundation of surveillance and that can be used for suppression. Yes, because if you think, when you tie all this together as well, Linda, when you think that your mobile location data, for example, they if you've got a mobile number and the electronic identifiers within your device, you can understand where groups are gathering, right? Where they want to go to a protest to listen to the opposition. If you understand where those groups are gathering, if you understand where they're moving to, then you can intercept those groups, you can corral them, you can herd them, you can prevent them listening to the opposition, which is a direct infringement of a person's right to freedom of expression, which is the right not only to say something, but the right to hear something. So yes, I am concerned.
Thank you. Thank you that for that part. And it says here, Vita, if you could make a comment as well.
Thanks, Linda. My comments will be limited to what, as Irungu had mentioned, on what we are trying to do as we approach the 2022 elections as Amnesty on the digital disruptors, is that we want to engage with young people who are active on the digital front, to just enable them and facilitate them to campaign on digital rights. This is the largest group of people who are actually using these digital systems currently. And the project, ideally, we're just trying to empower young activists to just campaign on these issues, on pushing back on mass surveillance capitalism by big tech, and just also going further to look at aspects such as online harassment, cyberbullying of young people and their mental well-being online. I think, Linda, I'll cede the floor back to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Victor. I want to ask that maybe we give the mic to Robert. Robert has been writing on this issue. Please introduce yourself. He's based out of Uganda. I think he has really great, you know, points to make. Robert?
This is a fascinating conversation. I have been listening very carefully. Excellent, excellent thoughts that everyone has been sharing. Let me just throw in perhaps a few comments. First, for everyone that's engaged in these issues, this is what I suggest. We have a tendency of being very active towards the election as we advocate for these issues and raise these questions. And then once the election is over, people sort of move back to what they were doing before. The problem with that approach is that we need to stop looking at these things as events and look at them as progressions. So we discussed Cambridge Analytica in Kenya as far back as 2013, but everywhere it went, it just refined what it was doing. I am not sure that there's many people out there discussing what happened to the Cambridge Analytica that got disbanded. Who are the new players? What are they actually up to? Because the tricks they will use are far more sophisticated. The second is we probably need to go further into discussing technology. I like what Boniface said, that you have different kinds of people. And the trick is getting stuck on one category and not minding the other. You have the Twitterati or the keyboard warriors, as we like to call them back here in Uganda. That's one category. And because they make too much noise, you will have extremist reactions from government, such as shutting down social media or turning off Facebook and turning off Twitter. But that's not the real end of the problem. The problem is that you then have issues that are systematic and then get entrenched in the way that elections are run. When we first had an internet shutdown in Uganda, it was minimal. You could still use email and stuff like that. The 2016 shutdown was not as bad. The 2021 shutdown was crazy. But also, in terms of what does that mean for democracy and for elections and for public participation and defining those rights, that's where I think that the next level of the discussion needs to go. Because we can all talk about, oh, Twitter and democracy and things like that. But when you get down to surveillance capitalism and the fusion between business and politics and how these platforms are programming people to think and to act and the noise they are causing, are they really engendering democracy or taking away from it? So let's not get limited into thinking about the impact of technology and digital spaces on the voting day and process so much as it is on the political rights and the public participation, because those stay even after the election. And that, for me, is one of the biggest lessons out of Uganda. So issues like when you talk about Huduma in Kenya, many times we like to think about the digital questions removed from the other questions around digital ID. If you talk about politics out of that space, I think you would be limiting the discussion. I guess what I'm trying to say here is that we need to look at data and how it's evolving and how it's getting used beyond just the polling day and the campaign season to what's happening before to entrench. So if you look at the evolution of Huduma and the background that someone just gave just now and what's been happening in Uganda, by law now, government can actually deny you services if you don't have a national ID. Here's the problem. National ID is tagged to SIM card registration. SIM card registration is now being tagged to COVID relief. Now, when we were talking about SIM card registration and national IDs, no one was thinking about elections. Now, the way we are defining society is tied to all of that, which comes down to what leaders do when they get elected. But remember, Article 1 of Uganda's constitution tells you you have the right to participate in the choosing of leaders. So when we are defining the political questions around data and technology and digital ID and these things, are we thinking beyond the election itself to say, okay, fine, we all know Cambridge Analytica was in Kenya in 2013. Then what? What happened after that? And so it's great to hear what Amnesty is doing and every player here, but do we have a cohort of players who are going to start asking the next dimension of questions? Because I think if you look at Uganda as a case study, and you look at Kenya, I mean, we come out of an election with all these technology issues, and then we're talking about disbanding the National IT Authority, which, by the way, is where the data office is. But these things seem like they are segregated, they're disjointed, but they're not. And the platforms know this, and these platforms are foreign, and they're interfering with democracy locally, automating elections and the thought process, behavioral surplus, and so on and so forth. So if I were to say one thing about what happens in this space and where the work should go, I think it should be where people like David Carroll and others have taken it to say, okay, fine, so there was a scandal with Cambridge Analytica. What then happens after that? And let's have those conversations to say, yes, has someone traced the journey in Kenyan elections and politics and political behavior and conversation between 2013 and today, and what should that say about 2022 and beyond? That, I think, would be a great project to look into, and especially how things have been evolving.
I'm just going to make a comment on, you know, the stuff that you have brought up. One is on, you know, the Uganda issue. We thought that, you know, internet shutdowns would not happen anywhere, you know, and then they happened in Uganda. And so we are not removed from that. We thought that Cambridge Analytica was, you know, an American problem. And then it happens in Kenya, and then it happens in the UK. And maybe that's going to happen a lot, you know, across the African continent. You know, what role are you playing? And maybe just to highlight the work that you do in this specific area on digital policy.
So we are involved in a number of things on digital policy at different dimensions. The most current at the policy level, so we've been writing the national 4IR strategy, which has taken longer than it should, but is now ready. And some of these questions arise, but then you realize they're much, much deeper. At the Center for Law and Emerging Tech, we are now going into some of these deep dives to say, okay, let's talk about things like exclusion and technology and human rights and what's happening there. We also have some work going on now with regard to technology, the internet, data, and democracy in itself. What is the way around the fusion between the platform level of analysis and control versus the masses? You can't remove the business questions from the human rights questions. These two are now so fused. So if you think about it, you have sort of three, the proverbial three cooking stones. And on the one hand, you have the big companies, government, and democracy. But in between those three cooking stones, you have two pieces, technology and the masses. And so we're doing some work around that to see, to analyze and see, do you need an African model for what we are calling pseudo-democracies? So you have the autocracies on the one hand, the Arab Spring, and where the Arab Spring happened, Iran, and so on and so forth. You have the West, where you have imperfect but fairly recognizable democracies, and you have the in-between. In Uganda, for instance, where we say we respect the rule of law, and then we'll shut down the internet willy-nilly in complete disregard of the constitution. That is pseudo-democracy. It's not really a democracy per se. So we're trying to define and say, can we have indigenous solutions to how the policy questions should evolve in technology and the role of UCC to have a human rights-centered approach to internet shutdowns. And so picking up on what's been happening and saying the questions of the future are bigger, let's try and define those conversations now. How you interpret privacy in the constitution versus digital technology. Those are some of the ongoing things that we're doing now, especially on the space on data. Big data and the masses, public participation is another project we're working on. to say, how does technology affect the traditional understanding of public participation in governance? That's some of the stuff that we're doing. This is specifically on data. There's a few other things beyond data.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Robert Tirunda. I hope I said it right. And I'm just going to highlight this as I go to my panelists, and we'll start from Pat. We'll make our final comments so that we can bring this to a wrap. And I'd really love to hear some, you know, steps on how do we move forward? How do we work together as well?
Yeah, I won't do the RSS. I was impressed with, you know, the Victor and Robert's intervention there. Robert is bang on when we talk about the right to political participation. And that right to political participation and your other rights, for example, to freedom of expression, are impacted greatly by network shutdowns and service restriction orders, which restrict access to social media. And I think the law needs to challenge those. And we need to think about mobile operators around the world rely on government largesse for their business. So they all operate under licenses, and that's the threat that the government get them by. But you asked about Cambridge Analytica, Robert. Yes, it's now those skills, those capabilities within a company called Emma Data Limited, which also is connected to another technology company. So those capabilities, Robert, you're absolutely right, exist. You should not only just think about them at the time of an election. To give you one example, I did an investigation for a journalist where I looked, there was an abortion referendum in Ireland, and an anti-abortion campaign was using two apps. And when I delved into those apps, I discovered that they was run by the same guy based in the US that ran the Trump campaign in 2016, and that also runs services for the NRA, so the National Rifle Association. Some pretty dirty stuff going on there. So all of that needs to be addressed, both the infrastructure by which people communicate and receive information, the data. So you have to ensure that the law is effective in relation to online collection and harvesting, and also your apps. But to take Victor's point about SMS and USSD, the law needs to address the use of electronic communication techniques, which is SMS, USSD, in-app notification, Bluetooth technology. As you're walking past a place, for example, you might get a Bluetooth notice. the law needs to effectively address that. You need to have effective regulation and robust enforcement. And those operators, I've worked in the mobile industry for 20 years. Those mobile operators should not be sending those messages, Victor. And I'd argue that if you look at the telecommunications license conditions under which those mobile operators operate, then there's probably a breach of duty of confidentiality and a breach of those license conditions, which civil society and others could begin to use to tackle that abuse of the position. Alinda, you raised a question about how can you curate your own news feeds. Well, I would say be very careful of the apps that you use. Often you'll find that they're riddled with data vampires, as I call them, with third-party trackers embedded in them that are linked to a range of other companies, hundreds and hundreds of companies. Use a browser, use tools to prevent the tracking online. You'll be amazed at how much you can stop. And use an RSS feeder to get information from trusted sources as well. Because, you know, Robert talked about it, and I think Victor talked about it, about the algorithms that curate what you see in an app. David Carroll talked about the fact he wasn't really aware that your session tonight was going on until it popped up in his timeline in Twitter, probably because you'd mentioned Cambridge Analytica, for example. So, but I use browsers, and I access most of these services via browsers rather than via the app, because I can use tools to prevent a lot of the tracking. I can go to an average website and find about 600 companies linked to many other companies just on one website. So I think tools and civil society could look at those tools as well and recommend recommendations on them.
Thank you very much, Pat, and thanks for your time. I love the tools that you have mentioned, and we sincerely appreciate it. We'll go to Victor.
Thanks, Linda. I think in the final comments, what I can mention is civil society, I think, will still keep vigilant eye on the developments in this sector. We'll continue to advocate on these issues. Excitingly, as an organization, we're now taking this project further to children, and so that young people are able to appreciate this concept at a very developmental stage, and them being the highest or the biggest users of these technologies at an early age, to give them the agency and the power to advocate for how these systems can be used to their benefit, push back on targeted surveillance of children in advertising. And I'm sure you guys may be aware that at some point in time last year, Senate discussed TikTok and its impact on our young people. And that was actually a positive step that such a discussion found itself on the floor of our house. And so it is increasingly important to create awareness on this topic across all cadres of life and all ages, so that people are able to push back, and just because the journey actually starts really with awareness. Thank you. Those would be my final comments.
Excellent. Thank you, Victor. I would now go to Robert Chirunda.
Thank you, Linda. There is one thing that I think needs highlighting, and I'll probably just pick from where Pat started at some point in his earlier comments, and that's the role that litigation plays in these things. The EU has benefited in a faster evolution of the legal framework and the human rights approach to these questions around data, because there is constant litigation that's happening and therefore shaping and reshaping and refining the issues. The Kenya Huduma case is a good example of what happens when we shed a spotlight on the big questions we're discussing today. I would urge everyone actively participating in these spaces to think about heightening the litigation around these questions on the African continent and for the African context, so that we can actually have definitive positions on the issues that are emerging and evolving. Also because that's the one way to educate the last frontier we have towards safeguarding our rights and these approaches, which is the courts. If Uganda is anything to go by, our judges need a lot of skilling in this space, and sometimes the fastest way they learn is when we hit them with the kinds of cases they were not expecting. So I'd say that one thing we can take away from all these conversations is that the politics and the privacy you can no longer just sit back and do nothing. That's not going to happen. So if you're not writing, please file a suit. There's always someone suing for something somewhere. We might as well start to raise the questions around these issues. And also, one thing I'm keen to do, if anyone on the group is interested, is to file across a suit on the same day across different countries on the continent, raising the same question. And then we see which court will decide first and how they will decide. So if Huduma had been done in Kenya, Uganda, and like five other countries at the same time, that might raise some noise. So Linda, there is an idea for you. I think that we will start to have a body of jurisprudence that is truly African indigenous, but also somehow coordinated and learning and building from each other.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Africa Law Tech Podcast. Make sure to follow us on Spotify and share this podcast with your friends. This podcast is hosted by The Lawyers Hub. The Lawyers Hub works on digital policy and legal innovation. To find out more about The Lawyers Hub, kindly visit lawyershub.org and africalawtech.com.